Some weeks ago, I was reading a copy of the Atni Rita, and there was a little piece in there that I was quite struck by. I forget exactly what it was that what was the occasion that had caused that person to write the speech. It might have been some protests about globalization. I think that's what it was. But the point that the person was making in writing the article was contemplating the word demonstration. Yeah, that he'd been more and more aware of how you know, the term demonstration had become associated with kind of angry protest or complaint or criticism, and so he'd been thinking about, well, if you want a demonstration, is really it's like you demonstrate something, you show something, you're an example of something. So he hatched the idea with some friends of rather than complaining about the way that others were doing it, like the global corporations and so forth, that they would demonstrate how they would live if they had, or that what they saw as a good example of ways of living, and so that they incorporated it in their you know, showing up at some kind of large gathering, along with the speeches and the banner waving. They had little kind of their own sort of free food kitchen and prayer circles and communal singing and basically a kind of a short-lived commune of goodwill and generosity and kind of spiritual support, spiritual engagement. And I thought it was a really beautiful way of shifting the view. These are very troubled times, and obviously in everyone's awareness that to some degree or another there's the war that has been enacted and the many demonstrations, protests that have been going on around the world against that. Many hundreds of people, 1,600 people were arrested in San Francisco the other day in terms of protests, blockading streets and other forms of civil disobedience. But it seemed that the element, and that, you know, that obviously that's all very worthwhile in bringing forth a statement of objection, and yet I felt this other element that this man was talking about was so crucial that it makes such a difference what we demonstrate, what we enact, how we do things, that we can, and if we're not including that, if we're not bringing that into the picture, then we can end up unwittingly contributing to the very thing that we feel that we are wanting to oppose. We become part of the problem rather than contributing to any element of the solution by the anger, the inner turbulence, the basic dualistic thinking that we bring in of a rigid sense of self and other, a rigid sense of right and wrong, of a rigid sense of good and evil, and the evil is to be destroyed and the good is to be kept. It also struck me that the Pali word desana, which we use for a Dhamma talk, also means a demonstration. This is a Dhamma demonstration. It is a showing. Desati means to show or to indicate. Dhamma desana means to indicate or to show, to demonstrate the Dhamma. Probably like many people, I've been experiencing a lot of fairly extreme mental states in the last few days. A lot of, great deal of sadness, depressed, sad, sorrowful feeling. A lot of agitation that the evening that the bombing began, even though I hadn't heard any reports, it was kind of due to start, and I found I could hardly sleep at all that night, and I was literally, sort of physically vibrating, and my body was just sort of in a very agitated, kind of over-energized, disturbed state. It was kind of very strange. Just kind of in a state of shock, and then just in different times in the last few days, just feeling really battered. Obviously, nothing like the kind of physical battering that's occurring in Iraq and so forth, but just the. The feeling of being kind of shocked, actually the sensation has been more like kind of being thumped by a baseball bat, sort of being thumped around mentally, you know, etherically, somewhere or other. So I don't know how much those feelings or experiences are shared by other people. We probably all have our own different nuances of how we have been experiencing these the news that we hear, or the effect on the people around us, or just the sense of what's in the air. But in terms of how we work with this in these times, these kind of experiences, or even if we're not sort of experiencing anything out of the ordinary at all, the question or the key piece of it is precisely how do we receive those experiences? How do we work with what arises, what we hear, what we see, what is going on around us, what we feel from the planet, from the people that we share our life with? How do we work with that? Last week, when Ajahn Pasana was talking, he was saying how he just heard some of the bad news just before the evening session began, and was kind of feeling turbulent, sort of turbulent feelings arising because of that, and then just seeing the moon rising over the hill, coming through the moonlight, coming through the window, sort of shifted his whole perspective. And I've also found a great deal of that, along with what I've been saying, which might sound a little bit kind of dramatic. Also, just walking through the forest between my kuti and the buildings down here and around and about, just seeing the spring flowers coming up, the wild irises emerging, and the new leaves on the oak trees. And there's this feeling of like, how can they do that? don't they know? They're just sort of carrying on like this is just an ordinary year, which of course it is. It's like, but it reveals that kind of reflection from the land that we live in. and the cycles of nature reflect that back to us, our own particular fascination, our own particular obsession. I mean, you can be sure that the frogs in the creek are not saying, well, what do you think about the American policy? What did you hear about what's been happening in Baghdad today? No, they're just frogs doing their spring thing. Like, you know, mate with me. They're not the slightest bit interested in human affairs. Unaffected by that. So that's the first thing, is in a way to see how our own feelings, our own fascinations, our own world is heavily crafted by our perceptions, our habits. We limit the world that we live in, that we experience so easily and so unconsciously, and so that we can sort of look at an iris and say, but how can you just sort of come up and just look normal? Don't you know there's a war on? And yet we can see that's like totally absurd, ridiculous. That's reflected back to us. The limited nature of our own focus, even though these are kind of desperately important issues in the human world, and for much of can deeply affect life on Earth in many ways. But also, first of all, to see that this is just my world. In Buddhist psychology, when the Buddha used the word world, loka, very explicitly he used it to refer to the world of our experience, the world as we experience it, not just the sort of abstracted external idea of the planet or the sort of geographical world, but the world as we see, hear, smell, taste and touch it, as it appears in our consciousness, this individual, as we ourselves experience the world. So it's intrinsically a world that is woven in together with personal conditioning, the patterns that our own karma, our own karmic tendencies create. So I find that is a very first reflection that's very helpful to bear in mind, is that my world is not everybody's world. My view, my feeling, my experience of happiness, unhappiness, or of neutral feelings is just what's happening here. It's just what's experienced in this particular sphere of awareness, this particular spot. It's not everybody's, it's not the same everywhere. And therefore my view, my outlook is is not universal, it's limited. So that it's, and then that helps us to recognize on a very, very basic level that this is not reality that we're experiencing, this is an event through a particular lens, a particular window that is being seen, a particular point of outlook. And as the Buddha pointed out in many, many different ways and different forms, that that is the gateway to wisdom, is recognizing this is an event, this is something that's arising, taking shape and dissolving in our consciousness. And that once that's seen, clearly known fully, then the heart has a chance to come into accord with the way things are. As long as we think our point of view is that which everything else should be measured by and judged by, then we have to create disharmony in ourselves and between ourselves and others, and continue the cycles of confusion. During these times when things are particularly turbulent, and also when we might feel so powerless, you know, on a global level, here we are in Northern California, even physically far away from Washington DC, where so many of the decisions are getting made that are affecting this situation. And even further away from the Middle East, where the effects of those decisions are really being borne out most painfully. And it's a constant kind of question in the air. It's you know, feeling so remote or so helpless or so small or such like a kind of bit player in such a huge drama. So for many people the question arises, well, what can I do? What can you do? And people wanting to contribute and act in ways that are helpful. So I find myself contemplating this because it does come up so vigorously and so universally. And what I found arising was really that you know, what we do is, you know, if we want to follow the advice of the enlightened ones, is the main thing to do is to practice right effort. In terms of doing, if we want to contemplate doing, acting, then what the teaching points directly to is sama vayamo, right effort. And there are obviously many things that can be done on the sort of external or social level, but in terms of wanting our actions to be a real demonstration of peace, a demonstration of wisdom, a demonstration of kindness, a real Dhamma Desana, an indication of Dhamma, a demonstration of Dhamma that can really genuinely help to be a part of the solution rather than just create more turbulence and conflict in the system. This really arose very clearly to me as being where we need to aim our efforts, our attention. Classically speaking, the right effort is outlined in four different dimensions. There are four different pieces to that. And the first of these is called Sangvara. Sangvara, which means restraint. So, and this is referring to restraining unwholesome tendencies, unwholesome states of mind, unwholesome actions, restraining them from arising. So, you know, here within the monastery, we're not too sort of, you know, physically, generally, we have a pretty restrained culture here. There's not too much sort of fist fighting or what kind of. It's all pretty mellow on the physical front. But particularly in terms of restraint, not just focusing on the physical side, but restraint, restraining the unwholesome in terms of, particularly of speech and of mind. This is very hard to do, to be cautious and to be, you know, to be honest, to be gentle, to be contributing towards concord rather than towards discord in the way that we speak is what the Buddha's teaching encourages. It's not easy to do. That we can feel intense feelings of hope or fear or indignation, anger, and they very easily, even though we might be physically restrained and committed to physical non-violence, can very easily spill out into words, into kind of snide little remarks or or not even snide, just kind of just straightforwardly, you know, insulting aggressive, abusive comments. And you know, I find this extremely. I have a very quick tongue, and very. I find it very easily that the an idea forms and spills right out of the mouth, and some kind of clever remark or some sort of neat demolition of some particular, you know, favored target can emerge. But you know, along with those kind of spitefulnesses that we experience a kind of pain in the heart, as a darkening of the heart and a discord that we bring about when we follow that. So it's very helpful, and not just sort of to be trying to be a kind of Pollyanna-ish way of functioning, not to just sort of try and be sort of nicey nice the whole time, but to just be trying to stick to the basic kind of pattern that the Buddha encouraged, which is saying to stick to the facts, to speak in ways that will contribute to harmony between beings, to speak with a heart of loving kindness, and to consider, you know, before we speak, you know, is it going to be helpful? Is this useful? Is this beneficial? Or is this just, you know, reiterating ideas for the sake of just having something to say, or just venting our, you know, an emotional state just because of wanting to blow off some steam? Is it going to be helpful? Is it going to be useful? So at least introducing some degree of, you know, caution and judiciousness and kind of circumspection in the way that we speak, what we choose to bring up, how we bring it up, what comments that we make, what we choose to pass on, what we choose not to pass on. Just not because of not wanting to say what needs to be said, but just to be aware of the karma that we create with our speech. And, you know, speech is the most potent form of human relationship. It's the channel through which most human relations happen. So it's particularly charged in that way. And when the Buddha talked about the five precepts in many different discourses, the precept on right speech gets as much coverage as all the other four precepts put together. So it's a loaded domain. In terms of meditation, which I found myself even kind of more focused on in the last few days, and maybe this is why the whole theme comes to mind, was just seeing the usefulness and the need for that quality of samvara, of restraint on that internal level, because of course speech is like, you know, one or two steps down the chain, because it, you know, the words are generally formed, or the ideas or the emotions are formed into conceptual thought, and emotional states have kind of taken shape within us and have got some momentum behind them before they emerge through the mouth, even though it can be a very quick process. It's often that we've been stewing on something, brewing, you know, something's been brewing up within us, been carrying it around for an hour or two, and then we find someone that we can share it with, and out it all comes. So I've been watching within the mind just a very accentuated tendency to be racing off into the past or the future, to be lurching into criticism or into despair or fantasy, just wanting to get away from the kind of uncomfortable, sad, depressed feeling, just the kind of dark, inner darkness. And there's quite a number of teachings, many teachings that the Buddha gave about meditation, where he framed his advice in terms of letting go of the past and the future, not fretting over the past, not hankering after the future, and not deluded by not creating ideas or views around the sense of self here in the present moment. There are many different teachings. The Bhadekarata Sutta, this discourse on one fortunate attachment. Another occasion where someone came to the Buddha and said, it's amazing, you know, I go and visit all these different spiritual teachers and these different yogis and ascetics and spiritual groups, wanderers. And whereas some of these other groups of monastics, they're sort of lean and haggard and their veins are standing out on their foreheads and they look all sort of, you know, leathery and weather-worn and gaunt. You know, when I come and visit you and your monastic community, then everyone seems, you know, very bright and radiant and bright-eyed. How come? And the Buddha says, they do not dwell upon the past, neither do they fret about the, neither do they hanker after the future, and they remain undeluded about the nature of the self here in the present moment. Therefore, they are radiant. I've always found that such a beautiful teaching, and very inspiring in its own way, and not just because it's a kind of hurrah for the home team, kind of waving the flag for the Bodhisattva. Yeah, we're better than those guys. We're not kind of lean and haggard and nasty like those ones. But I see myself in the mirror. We need to get rid of that mirror in the bathroom. I see myself early in the morning in that mirror. I definitely don't feel like one of the radiant ones. It's kind of increasingly wrinkled. Old guy staring out of the mirror at me in the morning. But particularly the usefulness of that teaching. And that's just exactly what happens. You know, it's really amazing that when we spend our energy chasing off into the past, creating futures, beautiful futures, ugly futures, reliving the past, kind of ugly pasts, beautiful past memories, or ugly memories that you then rearrange so that they're beautiful ones. Very popular pastime. How it should have been, could have been, rewriting my past. Generally speaking, I don't tend to do very much of. I did a humongous amount of that in the early years of monastic life. But it's interesting how these sort of threatening times and this feeling and the kind of turbulence in the air tends to bring that up more, that the mind wants to go back and rearrange the past and create futures and just fantasies of all different kinds, just to get away from this moment, get away from the present. But yet what happens when we do that, when we don't restrain that outflowing tendency, is that we lose our radiance, that any kind of brightness just diminishes and evaporates. And that's inner brightness, regardless of how it looks from the outside, but the inner sense of radiance and composure, it's gone completely. And just seeing how the heart is so greatly benefited by establishing that restraint, to just set those boundaries, right? That's the past, that's gone by, let go. Yeah. Don't follow that, or it hasn't happened yet. It might not be that way. No need to go there. No need to create that. It hasn't happened yet. That's not there. It doesn't exist. And just that feeling of of grief as we let go of that juicy fantasy or that kind of nice anguish that we were wrestling with. But I was enjoying moping about that. And then we let go of it, and then there's a kind of grief as we let go of that. But then when we come back to the present, then what we find is that the thing that was grieving was the ego, and the heart is actually relieved to be back here in the present moment. It's like a unconscious reaction. It's like an instinctual reaction that carries the attention away from the present, just that makes us not want to be with this moment, wanting to be somewhere else. But overriding that instinct, that habit, then we are sustaining or containing that energy, that inner brightness, gives it a possibility to shine. All the different elements of right effort, the four different pieces, all obviously interrelate and interweave with each other. So the second one is pahana. So just as sanglara is restraining unwholesome states from arising, then pahana is letting go of the unwholesome states that have already arisen when the mind has already grabbed hold of some kind of mood, some kind of feeling. It's got caught up in some anxiety or some passion or some fear, some aversion, and is well stuck into it. Then pahana means to let go of, just like in the chanting of the Dhammacakka Sutta that we did to begin the evening. For the second noble truth, following the Pali. You remember in the Uddhapadi sections, second of the Uddhapadi patches, there was for the second noble truth, it was Pahatabanti and Pahinanti. So Pahatabanti means to be let go of, Pahinanti means has been let go of. So Pahana means it's just like letting go, relinquishing, releasing. So the first thing about letting go is that we have to notice that we're holding on to begin with. And so as I was saying, like the kind of reflection that you get back from walking through the forest, and the kind of signal that my mood is not the mood of the universe, or that my outlook is not the absolute truth. These are the kind of ways that we can notice the more subtle forms of clinging, and there can be more kind of gross forms of clinging and distraction that we experience. And so when we say bring the attention back to the present, or we notice what's going on within us, just so that we feel that quality of suffering, and that's almost invariably a sign that we're attached to something. The heart is clinging, therefore there is suffering. So that's the clue, is that there's this feeling of suffering. So then the meditation guides us towards finding out what it is that we're clinging on to. If there's suffering, look around, cast the gaze around. What are we clinging to? What are we wanting? What are we fearing? What are we hating? What are we annoyed with? What are we upset with that is the cause of that? Sometimes it's, and just again, just sort of talking about or using my own kind of last few day experience of the last few days as an example, in that seeing how, that there's this kind of sadness and depression, just a heaviness, and just not wanting to to be with that, that the mind is like seeks some, you know, any kind of distraction, just wanting to go off somewhere else, to be somewhere else, to not attend to that feeling. So a lot of the times that we can be caught up in some state, and that the thing that we're caught up in is not really the issue. It can be like that there's something more kind of painful at the root that is causing that, and we're just picking up some other issue to get our mind off what is painful in the present moment. So to be able to see what it is that we're caught up with, to let go and come right back to the root is really important. And so as I was saying with that, I've been noticing my mind just kind of really not wanting to be with this kind of painful, sad feeling, wanting to go off in any direction, just to sort of not feel that. And even last night I even dreamt I was drunk. So I think this is getting serious. So, you know, obviously being as a Buddhist monk, you're not allowed to drink alcohol, but this is really interesting. The urge to get away from it is so strong that, you know, at least when I'm dreaming I can have a drink and get loaded and forget the whole thing. It wasn't very pleasant, but it was definitely I can't actually ever remember having been drunk in a dream before, but there it was. So this quality of letting go, you know, seeing the unwholesome states that have arisen, first of all noticing that it's a state, A, and not, it's not sort of the basic reality, and then B, then knowing that the way to respond to that state is to let go, is to see that we only create more problems by clinging to that, by wrestling against it, by believing in it, by being followed up by it. And so that what letting go means is an open-hearted acceptance, kind of a coming back to the root of the experience, and an open-hearted acceptance of it. So that, you know, say that when we are feeling something, you know, we're feeling stressed or pained or depressed or agitated or angry. As I said, you know, there can be huge tendencies to want to get away from that, to act it out, or to not feel it, to get away from it. But when we come back to that experience, we sort of, okay, we let go of the distraction, we come back to that sort of root feeling and say, yeah, well, this is really painful, I don't want to be with this, this is horrible. And so that, you know, that how do we let go of an uncomfortable feeling? It doesn't have to be emotional, it can be physical, it can be some kind of physical pain as well. It all works in the same way. So to first of all recognize that it's completely natural for us to not like it. It's not, we're not trying to get to a place where we are like not feeling anything, or that where we're finding a place where we can actually like sadness, or we can like anger, or we can like grief. It's not a matter of trying to sort of conjure up a liking, but it's a more like a quality of profound patience. In the Buddha's first instruction to his community on the discipline, which was the 1,250 arahants, the opening lines of his little Dhamma talk was Kanti paramang tapo titika nibbanang paramang vadanti buddha, which means patient endurance is the supreme practice for burning up unwholesome states. This is the 1,250 arahants. And that's a powerful teaching. Patient endurance is the supreme practice, the tapas, the supreme austerity. So what that means is that there's this capacity that we have to be patient and for letting go, particularly letting go of painful mental states, as this profound acceptance and patience that is needed to be cultivated, where we allow that into the heart, we can feel that kind of heaviness or disturbance or rage. And we know that it's there, we're fully attentive to it. We're not pushing it away, we're not being sucked in by it, we're not believing in it, we're not getting caught up in its stories. But we simply know there is this feeling, here it is, it's like this. And then, again, as I said at the very beginning, that the sense of the fundamental recognition of this is a state brings with it the intuition that this has arisen. This is not a permanent thing. This is not the basic reality. This is my world. It has arisen. It's a turning world. It's a changing world. This pattern has arisen. Therefore, it has to fade away. It's not a permanent thing. So then, that opening of the heart to it is not saying, okay, I'm ready to be like this forever, or this is the basic reality, okay, I'm stuck with this for good. That openness of the heart actually brings with it the intuition of, yeah, this is painful, but it's also just another changing condition. And so we're with it as it forms, as it's there, and then sure enough, sooner or later, it lives its life through and fades. So that there's no kind of negotiation or bargaining with it, we're just allowing it to be there. But in a way, we're feeling the space around it, the space within it. The transparency of that experience. And the third of the pieces of right effort is bhavana. Again, for those who are paying extremely close attention to the Pali in the Dhammacakka Sutta, the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, the way of working with the fourth truth is bhavetabhanti, to be cultivated, and bhavitanti, has been cultivated, so that the Eightfold Path is what is to be developed as the fourth noble truth. So bhavana, in terms of right effort, is a cultivation of the wholesome, bringing that into being, giving rise to the wholesome. So you have restraining the unwholesome from arising, or if the unwholesome has arisen, then letting go of it once it has arisen. Consciously cultivating the wholesome, bringing that forth. So this is also to do with like setting an intention. We can't force wholesome states to arise. Obviously, I will be good. I will not be angry. You can't make nature be the way you like it. It's like sort of standing over an iris bud saying, open! Spring, come on! Open up! It's ridiculous. It'll do its thing in its own time. But we can set an intention. We can set a direction for ourselves. So that the cultivation of wholesome states is that clear setting of a direction, say to cultivate the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, mudita, and upekkha, equanimity. And these are the kind of spirit that lies behind, say, the recitation of the Metta Sutta, sharing of blessings that we do regularly here, the establishment of say, Metta practice, loving kindness meditation. All these are ways of setting the pattern, setting the intention for us to bring forth those qualities, so that we're reminding ourselves there is that capacity that we have as human beings to respond in a wholesome and skillful way, a bright way. The one of the teachings where the Buddha described the Brahma Viharas and the chant that we, one of the chants that we do, you know, reciting the qualities of the four Brahma Viharas, is in a discourse called the Simile of the Saw, which probably most people are familiar with. And in that discourse, the Buddha lays out his perspective on loving kindness and its applicability, and its relate, and also the his outlook on aversion, on negativity. And again, this is like the discourse about letting go of past and future. This is one of those teachings that is really striking and potent, because the Buddha deliberately uses a kind of an absurd example to get our attention and to set the standard, whereby he says, if you were kidnapped by bandits and they were sawing your arms and legs off, he said, with a two-handled saw. So there you are, you're strapped down and they're sawing your arms and legs off. Anyone who gave rise to a thought of hatred towards those people on account of that would not be practicing my teaching. And so, yeah, no matter how many times I say that, you know, I know the teaching already, and even when I'm just saying it out loud, you can feel a sort of internal gulp going on. Gee, that's like starting the high jump with a bar at 6 feet, you know, it's like, wow. It's a bit of a leap. But, you know, the Buddha was an extraordinarily brilliant teacher, and so he was totally aware that this is a bit of a daunting task, or like, you know, that our normal human instincts would say, well, hang on, wait a minute. Can't we kind of lower the bar a little bit, you know, and sort of work with someone who sort of just says something nasty to you, or kind of cheats on you, or rips you off, or burgles you or something. But he doesn't, he just kind of leads, you know, straight with a, you know, right hook to the jaw. And that, so it's a situation that you would feel utterly justified in feeling negative, you know, and feeling hatred towards the people who, you know, they not only they kidnapped you, but they're cutting you up into pieces. They're killing you and causing you immense pain at the same time. And the Buddha says, not even should you not arouse aversion to them, but you should cultivate wishes for their welfare while they're cutting you up. So intrinsic in establishing a relationship with other beings is this quality of compassion and benevolence. That even in a situation like that, it's totally appropriate to cultivate, you know, wishing someone else's welfare, even when they're cutting you up, killing you. That sort of resentment and hatred is intrinsically counter to the Dhamma, to the way things are, to the, you know, fundamental reality of things. That creation of other a kind of fundamental hatred. So in terms of cultivation of wholesome states, these are really helpful standards to have in place to set that intention, to share the blessings of our life with all beings, those who are perpetrating great harm, those who have been great sources of happiness and support and kindness for us, those who love us, those who hate us, those who are indifferent to us, those whom we love, and so forth. The whole array of beings, to share the blessings of our life consciously, share the good karma of our life, to wish well to all beings. Doesn't mean to say that we wish them success in all their endeavors, But we wish them as beings all good. The last of the four right efforts is anurakana, which means protection, to protect or to cherish. Rakati, to protect, and so this means to protect the wholesome states that have arisen. So, having cultivated the wholesome states, bhavana is to bring wholesome states into being, and anurakana is to cherish or to sustain, to maintain, to protect whatever wholesome states have been established. Now there are, you know, many different ways of relating to this, but what came to my mind and is also a way of what one can contribute very definitely in terms of what, you know, this whole theme of what I've been talking about in terms of what we can do is that of sila or virtue that in Thailand they use the phrase to look after when you're taking precepts or keeping precepts they actually use the word raksa, which comes from the same as the Pali, which means to protect. Like, so they talk about rather than keeping the sila, like keeping the precepts, they would like say they protect the precepts, raksa sin, and someone who protects the precepts, cherishes the precepts, which has got a very beautiful tone to it, which is sort of taking in English doesn't quite carry in the same way. And they also have a very beautiful expression which is I find similarly helpful, which is tum, and Ajahn Pasana can correct my bad Thai tones. Tum raksa sin, sin raksa tum, which means the Dhamma protects the sila, sila protects the Dhamma. Which means when we look after the sila, when we take our precepts seriously, then that helps to keep the heart aligned with Dhamma. It keeps our other heart in tune with the way things are, and keeps our actions and our speech and our attitudes in alignment with the ultimate reality of things, the true Dhamma. And similarly, when the heart is awakened to Dhamma, when we are truly mindful and practicing with kindness and wisdom and attention, then naturally we will be inclined towards a virtuous manner in the world. We will be respectful and gentle and honest in the way we function in the world. So that there's a kind of two-way traffic that is reflected there, and it's really summarized very neatly in that phrase: tam raksa sin, sin raksa tam. The Dhamma looks after the sila, sila protects the Dhamma. So that when we relate to our precepts, this is and protecting the precepts, this is a the most, you know, a solid practical way that we can or a thing that we can contribute to the world at this time is an individual commitment to sila. And it does, obviously we need to understand how to relate skillfully to precepts, you know, to that certainly we recognize that we break precepts all the time. We're always kind of overstepping the mark. You know, the heart gets carried away by some wave of, you know, fear or agitation or just kind of being unmindful and sort of habitual action of some kind, or an aversion, or a burst of lust or greed or fear, and suddenly we find that we've said something or done something or followed some kind of fallen into some kind of rut, followed some action that is against the precepts. So it's really important to see that you know, within the Buddhist world, that we use the precepts as a way of helping us to recognize that quality of having drifted off the track, of having left the quality of accord with Dhamma. So that, you know, even though we might break precepts or you know, go against them, transgress them, you know, over and over again or regularly, or we might feel that we don't keep them very well, the very fact that we respect them and that we are endeavoring to keep them and that we hold them in great regard and keep using the precepts in a very sincere and honest way as our reference point, that's the important thing, you know, that we keep coming back to that and keep recognizing when our transgressions occur. So it's not a matter of like never transgressing the precepts or never making mistakes or always being perfect in what we say and what we do and how we relate to other people. It's not a matter of like sterilizing our actions, but seeing that, yeah, we do make mistakes, but recognizing when a mistake is a mistake and doing what we can to rectify that, doing what we can to endeavor to not follow that same habit in the future. So that we're guided by that. So protecting the precepts really means cultivating that fundamental respect for the sila. It doesn't mean like a sort of an ever more rigid kind of clinging to them. It means that like a deep, heartfelt cherishing of sila as a sure guide towards a benefit for ourselves and other beings. And the more that we respect the sila, and the more that that is a real guiding light for us, then that radiates out from our lives to the lives of others, and becomes an example to others, and our own presence becomes something that is something more of a blessing to ourselves and also the people around us. So these are some reflections on what we can do and what to do, how to do, what can be done in these turbulent times. So whatever is useful of this, please retain that, and whatever is not, please just leave aside. Anyone?